Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora. I'm joined today by Dr. Tarun Khanna, who's the Jorge Paulo Lehman Professor at the Harvard Business School. More than a mouthful. Where he studied and worked with entrepreneurs, investors, and emerging markets worldwide. Does a lot of things. He was named Harvard University's Director of the South Asia Institute in 2010. He joined HBS originally in 1993. He came out of Princeton with an engineering degree in 88 and then a PhD from Harvard. He also had a short interim stint on Wall Street. We'll get to that in a moment. He's also served at the head of several courses on strategy, corporate governance, international business. He also teaches in the undergrad program there in the general education core curriculum. He also works with the HBS Owner President Management Executive Education Program. He also has focused quite a bit on activities in India and South Asia. He was also nominated earlier on to be a young global leader at the World Economic Forum, and many, many awards, too long and too numerous to name here. So, Tarun, welcome to the show.
Thank you, MR. It's nice to be here.
Terrific. So, you grew up in India, and as everyone knows, the childhood years are the most formative years for all of us, and you spent a good deal of that in India. So, can you just tell us a little bit where you grew up and what your family life was like when you were in India before you came to the U.S.?
Sure. I came to the U.S. when I was 18 to go to college, and so until 18, I was very much anchored in India. Never left the country, and very happy to be there. Had a very happy childhood. Fortunately, upper middle class type of upbringing. Mostly studied in Bombay. It was then Bombay, now Mumbai, I guess. And then went to high school in Bangalore because of a family shift in situation. Though my origins are in the Punjab and Delhi, so that remains the sort of ancestral base. But as a result, I saw a good deal of India, and particularly enjoyed my Bangalore days, which I guess was my adolescence. So it was a lot of fun, and made and kept a good deal of wonderful, wonderful friends.
Yeah, at that time, Bangalore was actually a livable city, I'm sure.
Yes, and we used to complain then that the Bangalore of, 10 years prior to that time, in the 70s, even nicer, so it was all relative.
So what made you come to the U.S. and study? What drove you to the United States?
A little bit of serendipity and maybe wanderlust, I suppose. I mean, I went to IIT Madras. And sort of matriculated. I was ready to go, and then was admitted to a bunch of good U.S. schools with lots of award money, and it seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up. I remember having a lot of angst about it and saying this seems like a crazy move. But my parents, were always supportive of adventure and thought it would be a good developmental idea. So I sort of had to walk away from IIT. Where again, I made some good friends and kept some good friends. Mm-hmm. Ended up coming to Princeton, which was really just a fabulous 4-year fairy tale type of experience. Mm-hmm.
So how do you shift? How does one shift from engineering to economics? That's a pretty big move.
No ability to tell you a cogent, rational story about anything. I think really it's more a story of mentors and impressive people. And I think one of the things when I now in sort of middle age reflect back on things that have happened serendipitously to me, I guess the only unifying thread throughout is I've been lucky enough to attract fabulous mentors. Of course, there's some hard work involved in that also, but also some luck, a good deal of luck. And I think one of the sets of mentors at Princeton was a mathematician who was doing a lot of applied economics work, and he somehow noticed what I was doing as an undergraduate in computer science and engineering and applied math, and said, why don't you try this stuff about financial markets with a very impressive young scholar. And I got hooked by it and was sufficiently intrigued that I turned down my sort of PhD computer science type of places, nice offers that I had at the time, and in a confused fashion, drifted off to Wall Street, which was what all the lemmings who were confused were doing at the time. And that was fine. And then a year later, I, you know, decided, hey, I would go try this Harvard thing and see what this economics was about. And, you know, the motivation at the time, at least the self-rationalization to me was I would teach myself a different way to think than being an applied mathematician engineer. And that part, at least, I'm glad I did, which is, you know, I saw a different set of lenses through which to view the world, and I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, so let's stay on the topic of mentors for a moment, because I went through that myself in my career. And so how does one go about getting a mentor? Because when you're 18 or 20, you really don't know what's going on in life. Can you shed some wisdom on that? Because now you are acting as a mentor to others. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's I don't know about the wisdom part, but we can talk about it and see what comes out of our conversation. You know, I guess by nature I'm curious, and I like reading just about anything. And my honest, vague recollection is there was a fellow at Princeton named Sonnenschein, who was a mathematician. He's got a lot of theorems named after him, and I was intrigued by, you know, when I ran into him somewhere, I think at a student dinner, and we got to talking, and he asked me to come see him. And it turned out that every year he had this little, well, I don't know if it was every year or not, but every so often he would run into people who were outside of his chosen field, which was sort of a fairly technical branch of economics. And he would introduce them to what he thought was beautiful, which was mathematical economics. And my year, there was a guy from the physics department and myself who he picked. The other guy, Aaron, went to Stanford and then eventually became professor at Berkeley. And I came to Harvard and stayed here. But he was in the racket of finding what he thought were talented people and steering them to what he thought was a beautiful profession. And his enthusiasm was contagious. I don't know that I was ever, you know, looking for anything. I was perfectly happy where I was. And on my own little meandering path to mathematics and computer science and algorithm design and other such things, which would have been fine. It's just that I ran into this guy who was so excited about what he was doing. So I kind of, you know, like any impressionable kid, I said, hey, this guy seems really interested and smart, and let's go see what he's doing. And before I knew it, I found myself in so that's pretty much it, I think.
Great. No, that's terrific. That's a great story. Then the next step is you did this stuff on Wall Street, and then you went into academia. That also is a big shift, right? So can you –
is a story of mentors at the end of the day. And, you know, as I reflect, I keep telling my students that my decision-making calculus is not one I could with any good conscience recommend to them, because it was really quite flawed. But in the interest of candor, mm-hmm. share with you what I actually thought, you know, at the risk of really embarrassing myself. But I'm a competitive person by nature, and I thought that the MBA program in the good schools was not really competitive. And when I heard that there was this other program that was much more competitive, which happened to be a PhD, I said, that's the one I'm going to do, which was a little bit silly, because, of course, it's not how you should think of a PhD program. You should think of it as something, you know, intellectually stimulating that you are excited to do and so on. And I jumped into it. And at the end of it was really in two minds. So kind of went through it very, very fast. And at the end of it was in two minds about whether to stay in academics or not. And again, ran into two mentors. One was Mike Porter, mm-hmm. who is a little bit of a guru in our world. Very, very successful economist, and then latterly turned into a business guru, but very thoughtful, thoughtful person with a great deal of impact on the world. And Mike was, again, you know, like Hugo, the mentor at Princeton, who became the president of the University of Chicago eventually. Like Hugo, Mike was very, very charismatic and excited about what he did. And the other guy was Kim Clark, who subsequently became dean of Harvard Business School. So, you know, very different people, Hugo, Mike, Kim, very different backgrounds, very different interests. But the thing that was common across all of them was that they were genuinely and passionately in love with what they did. And I think that's probably the quality that seems to me to be most instrumental in attracting, you know, sort of a mentor, attracting someone to a potential mentor. You know, upon reflection, that's kind of what I think. So that's how I stayed in academia, because Kim and Mike sort of persuaded me that this was an endlessly interesting job to have, or hobby to have. It's hard to really call it a job if you think of a job with its negative. I mean, I keep thinking it's amazing that anybody pays us to keep doing whatever we want. It's, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful privilege.
But you've worn, Tarun, a number of hats at Harvard. So amongst all those, what stands out? What's your most challenging job that you look back on, or is it the current one?
So I have and continue to wear many hats, but I think the most challenging, and something that's always been the most challenging and rewarding and satisfying for me anyway, has been working with very talented PhD students. You know, so each one is, I don't know if this is the right phraseology, is an individual effort, obviously on the part of the student, on the young man or young woman, but on my part also, and the other people that the person is working with, and shaping them into something that their intellect into something that they can be very happy and proud with, and then ultimately guiding them the way, you know, Mike and Kim and others guided me and said, this looks like a good thing for you. And sometimes it means guiding them out of academia and saying, you know, this is not something for you. But being, a guide and a teacher and obviously a researcher and academic and then ultimately a friend and mentor to these people. And I'm just so grateful that some of my best relationships after 20-plus years of doing this are some of my students, you know, especially my PhD students who I stay in touch with. Many of them are running very large corporations. Some have become entrepreneurs. Some are chaired professors. Some have won all sorts of amazing awards that are far in excess of mine. And it's really quite amazing. I love it. And that's
very,
the hardest. Most
very gratifying, it looks like. So I know you have a title of the Jorge Paulo Lehmann Professor. What is that role?
It's just a chaired professorship.
Okay.
Our chairs, as in other universities, are named after the donors, or whomever the donor designates as what he or she wants the chair to be named for. Typically, it's the donor or the donor's family. Giorgio Paulo is one of Brazil's most successful businessmen. He's been in the news a lot. He's the guy behind a firm called 3G Capital.
Mm-hmm.
Is a controlling shareholder of Anheuser-Busch and Burger King and Wendy's and Tim Hortons and Heinz, and works with Buffett a lot. So he's in the news a lot. But he's, more importantly than that, he's just a wonderful, wonderful entrepreneur, self-made man, and just a nice, nice, decent guy. So he's, you know, he's the one who gave the chair, and I guess the reason the chair was matched to me is that Paulo really cares about entrepreneurship as being the route to economic development. And that's a position that I very, very passionately identify with. And increasingly what I see as what I hope will be my life's work is to help shape entrepreneurship in the developing world, particularly in India, which of course remains my country of origin. And so Giorgio Paulo and I share a lot of interests. I, from the academic side and through my own entrepreneurial ventures, and Giorgio Paulo as a, you know, day in and day out swashbuckling entrepreneur. So that's the chair.
Great. So, as a professor, you've also authored many books and papers. So is entrepreneurship a core part of the research you've done and the papers and books you've written, and is that the underlying theme?
Yeah, pretty much. It is. I mean, at the outset, it was not an explicit theme.
Yeah.
But, I was just trying to explain to myself why it was that the things that I was taught in the first year of the MBA program didn't really, you know, this is going back now, didn't ring true to me when I thought about our family businesses in New Delhi or Bangalore, in the sense that some of the actions that were being prescribed in the class discussion, I would all often find myself thinking, you know, would that work in Hubli, which is a town outside Bangalore, or Ludhiana somewhere? And I often said, it's not going to work. And I began to then think, as an academic, how do you think about the contextual reality in which a manager, an entrepreneur, investor finds themselves, and how should that factor into appropriate decision making? So that was the big idea, and the canvas on which I wanted to paint as an academic, and that led me to spend a lot of time with entrepreneurs, particularly in China and India, and I spent a huge amount of time in China over the last two decades, and also through the Jorge Paulo relationship in Brazil, and some of the other developing countries, and began increasingly to think about entrepreneurs as the source of true dynamism and economic growth in developing countries, particularly when, as I see it, the alternative models haven't, I wouldn't say been discredited, but haven't really lived up to the full promise of aid-driven development or charitable development and things of that nature. That theme of individual agency, what can you do to fix the situation that you're in or to make the most of it in a constructive way, that's the theme that animates all my work, both as an academic and as an entrepreneur.
Oh, great theme there. But how do you kind of balance in your profession? I'm sure academics go through this between teaching, consulting, and writing. How do you do that?
You know, I would say less well than I'd like to. Is how do I balance less well? But you know, more seriously, I think the balancing is easier because everything is about the same thing in some ways. I mean, you know, what I'm studying is entrepreneurship, and to the extent that I do outside advisory work, which you know, by design and by intent has to be quite contained. It's also about entrepreneurship. And then when I'm building my own companies and nonprofits, initially primarily in India, but now more and more in other parts of the developing world, again, it's about entrepreneurship. So in some sense, I'm practicing what I'm preaching. And in a curious way, some of the ventures are now generating so much interesting data that academics have begun to use the data. So it really is a satisfying full circle where the research gave rise to ideas that we then used to launch companies, and the companies then generated data that now other academics use. So it's a nice little fulfilling, if somewhat small, circle.
Fascinating. Very fascinating. Folks, don't go away. We'll be back after a short break. Hello again, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora. We're back with Dr. Tarun Khanna with the Harvard Business School. So, Tarun, the other thing is you're on the board now of several companies. With these companies, are you a mentor? Is it more of an independent director? What is your typical role in these companies as a board member?
So I would say there's two kinds of companies that I'm involved with in the capacity as a board member. One are sort of existing large companies that I had no role in creating. They're just, some of them are large and some are really large, and there I am an independent director and, you know, member of a set of peers who are from different walks of life, like any publicly traded board, and have a little bit of both oversight responsibility that an independent director has, and of course, the responsibility to add my voice to whatever decisions are on the table. The other companies are those where I have had a role in creating, which are mostly younger and smaller, but in some cases not as small as they used to be, that started between, you know, 6, 7 and 2 years ago, and are rapidly growing ventures. They're mostly run by my students. So that's a very different role as a co-creator of the company. And both are, again, very satisfying and really, really stimulating. And I see it very much as part of my research in many ways, because, again, working with people who are enmeshed in the process of economic development.
So let's stay on that topic for a moment, on young entrepreneurs and co-creating companies. Can you give us an example of a couple of these companies and how they have come about and what they're up to?
Sure. Let me think which ones should we use. So there was one company that, I'll pick a couple of examples that
sure.
are doing well, but I've had a goodly share of failures, I should say, like anybody who would try, and that's, I guess if I didn't, then I probably wasn't trying to do anything interesting. So one company that's doing quite well, touch wood, is a company called Aspiring Minds. And it's a company that, you know, in the jargon we say is a machine learning company that we would aspire to say democratizes access to talent around the world. But with less fancy jargon, what it really does is it allows people who don't have, who are not in the economic mainstream, to be tested by our adaptive sort of artificial intelligence tests. So that as long as they do well on the test, they are comparable to anybody who comes from a fancy school or a fancy background, and they have an equal shot at getting a job in the economic mainstream, white-collar job in the economic mainstream. That was the idea, and the proposition to the companies was that we can help you find talent that you would otherwise not be able to get to. So we created this business idea 7, 8 years ago, and it has done remarkably well. And I think I'm very proud that it's genuinely democratized access to talent. And now the technology is being used in half a dozen other countries. We've just opened our subsidiary in China, and we've got a growing effort in India, a small effort in Africa, a small effort in Southeast Asia, a small effort in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And we just run a lot of machine learning tests that allow people at all skill levels, from very, very high-end conceptual levels to vocational skills, to enter the workforce, enter the formal workforce. And in that sense, we're kind of leveling the playing field so that the accident of your birth or background is, we hope, less of an impediment for you to contribute to society. Ultimately, that's what makes development occur and societies move forward, is if talent is given free access. You don't need to be from a politically connected or a wealthy family to start something on your own or get going with your professional life. So that's been a really, really fun company to work with and create.
Why don't you give us another example just to contrast that one?
A very, very different example is something that in my mind I thought would be like a Starbucks for poor people. You know, it's easy for people to relate to. They understand Starbucks. And but, you know, Starbucks in, you know, a simple cup of coffee in China is priced at, I don't know, I want to say $3.
Right.
And in India, the Starbucks they've opened, I think, is about $2 or $3 as well. $2 probably. So it's quite unaffordable. And it's a very high-end experience in many ways. And if you grew up, as I did in India, and you saw the chaiwala, the tea boy, who's wandering around in the street serving dirty tea in a dirty cup, I thought we could do better with that and in the process provide a better, you know, daily experience. What could be more humdrum and routine in India than having a cup of tea a few times a day? And that's the reason we fixated on it, my student and I in Bangalore. And we built this company called Chai Point, which started off with a single store in Koramangala in Bangalore, for those of you who know Bangalore. And, you know, it took a couple of years to refine the model and get it right. But now we are growing extremely fast, and we have a number of exciting parts of that business. We're in 3 cities, Bangalore, Delhi, and Pune, expanding to another 3 this year. We've got I'll probably get these numbers wrong, between 75 and 100 stores open, cafes open, which mostly serve the lower end of the income spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely cheap tea. It's the cheapest tea is about 10 cents as opposed to $2. So it's a steep, steep fall from a Starbucks. It's not coffee, it's just tea.
Yeah.
And we have a few snacks, and we generate employment for a lot of uneducated kids who we bring into the workforce. And one of the coolest things in that business is we have a chai on call business, which is growing like gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
What it is it's a set of simple algorithms, about, I want to say, 20 or 30 electric bikes in Bangalore, and some apps on phones. So you can call up a flask of tea, and a boy will come on an electric bike and deliver it to you in very, very little time.
Wow.
Piping hot tea, and it's taken the city by storm, so it's growing extremely fast. So we're building that piece by piece. And again, it's run by one of my students who he and I are partners in starting it up. And it's just amazing what you can do when you approach it like a creative problem. So but it's simple. It's the most simple product in the world. It's very high quality, standard, extremely cheap tea, very clean.
I'm going to try it the next time I'm in Bangalore this fall, so I look forward to that. But Tarun, tell me something. What did you learn from the failure?
You know, a lot. I mean, one thing I learned, which I knew intellectually, but you learn it quite dramatically when you lose a lot of money on it. One thing I learned is that one of the reasons entrepreneurship is so difficult in the developing world is that idiosyncratic events can really derail you for two reasons. One, idiosyncratic events are more frequent because a lot of them have to do with the political economy of these countries, corruption being a big and regular feature, erratic regulatory action with limited checks and balances being another source of idiosyncratic disarray. And so it happens a lot more. And if you're a young fledgling company with, you know, minimal resources and scraping together an existence, like the proverbial guy in the garage or somebody in the couch, sitting on a couch, sleeping on a couch, it's very hard to survive body blows like that. Mm-hmm. And when the depth of angel capital and risk capital is relatively shallow in developing countries, not just in India, but most developing countries, then a body blow like that can really derail you. So I've had at least three ventures that have died as a result of idiosyncratic events that had nothing to do with the venture. So that to me is a big kind of obvious thing that I intellectually knew because, you know, I teach about instability and corruption. But, you know, when you see it face to face and you're not willing to play that game, then you don't have any option but to shut it down. So that I would say that that's been the biggest lesson for me. And the other one, if I may, Amar, is totally different and I guess applies as much to Boston and San Francisco as it does to Bangalore and Guangzhou. And that has to do with, I don't know what the right word is, emotional stability of the entrepreneur. So one of the things I tell my students is, you know, do it if you're excited, particularly in the developing world where the instability is so much greater. Do it if you're excited, but also do it as long as you have enough support around you. And I don't mean just financial support. I mean that you're ready for there to be extreme volatility in your life for a few years. And honestly, I had not appreciated that until I had a few students that I kind of steered in this direction because they were all excited about something they were doing. And then I realized that, you know, for whatever reason, their immediate families were not supportive of this. And, for good reason from their standpoint. And I realized that that's something that's really worth paying attention to. So there's a time and a place for things like that. So those, I would say, are two very helpful lessons for me that I keep reminding myself of.
Yeah. Maybe I think you should do a few case studies on your companies and stuff, Tarun, if you haven't already.
I think others should do it because...
Yeah, that's true. That is true. To digress for a moment, let's talk about the World Economic Forum. You've been there many a time.
Yeah.
So what is that experience like? Is that something... young entrepreneurs should aspire to go to? Is that a life-changing event?
So I would say, first of all, I went to the the World Economic Forum, to the Davos meetings several times, some years ago, and I haven't been for several years. I remain connected to the community because it's an impressive community, and it's an easy way to connect to a lot of people. So I highly encourage anybody who has an opportunity to engage with them to engage with them. And one of the things that's happened with the World Economic Forum over the last 10 years is that the avenues for engagement have dramatically multiplied. It used to be there was just one prestigious annual meeting, and you went to it or you didn't go to it. But now there are so many World Economic Forum events in every part of the world, and so many specialized industry events and web-based stuff, and so there are many avenues to engage with it. So I'm a big supporter of the World Economic Forum and feel that people should engage with it. I wouldn't say it was a life-changing event. I mean, I was very happy doing what I was doing, and if I had not gone, I don't think it would have been very different, but it was extremely fun and extremely interesting and useful to go to. And, just a nice community of, of course, some people who were very self-important and not so much fun to be around as far as I was concerned, but also a lot of achievers and people genuinely out to get good things done. And that's the part that resonates with me. So it's been, a privilege. As I say, MR, you know, the story of my life has been I attract mentors. So
yeah,
that's the nice part.
So. Yeah, I'm going to name you the mentor magnet, Tarun.
from your lips to the ears of God is, I think, the really proverbs.
So let's get to the fun part. We're going to close pretty soon. So let's get to the fun part. So what do you do in your spare time? How do you relax?
Oh, you know, I love to travel. I mean, yeah. That's part of my professional avocation also, but I love to travel. So my kids and wife and I just went to the Atacama Desert a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
Which is the driest place on Earth. Except, can you believe it? On the driest place on Earth, there was a freak rainfall when we were there. So.
I forgot, you're from Boston. What do you think?
That's right. What was I thinking? We attract bad weather. So, other than that, it was just a spectacular visual extravaganza. It's the most amazing place to see the night sky.
Yeah.
It's the astronomers, paradise, and just endless miles of salt flats and desert and beautiful landscape, and you can climb in a sort of jeep for an hour, and you're in snow-capped Andes, and then on the bottom of it is just sand dunes and desert. So it's really quite spectacular. I like going to crazy places. My son and I went to the Malaysian rainforest looking for exotic animals a couple of years ago. So that's what I love to do. I love traveling and observing and reading and talking to people, so, and hanging out with my kids, which is really amazing.
We have a lot in common. I do the same thing as well. Try to go to different exotic places, and it's truly amazing. And we're fortunate to be able to.
That's right. Not everybody is lucky, so it's good fun. So that's.
So one last question for you, Tarun, is what is one thing that your friends and colleagues don't know about you? Put you on the spot here.
Don't know about me. How utterly disorganized I am. Utterly disorganized. Compounded by my tendency to take on just about anything that sounds cool and exciting, and then... You know, the only thing that saves me is your coined phrase, MR, mentor magnet. There's so many people around me who keep saving me.
that's terrific. This has been a fascinating conversation, Tarun. Maybe we should pick it up again another time.
Well, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to chat, and look forward to connecting somewhere again, physically.
Absolutely.
Your team
absolutely.
And you.
Thank you, Tarun. And this show is produced by Monica Patel. And the theme music is by our very own Rina Ismail. So long, everyone.